Welcome back to the Mutica Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is Pierce Bauer.
What's up, John?
Hi, Pierce. How are you?
Pretty good. It's the most wonderful time of year.
It sure is. We are a couple weeks away from the Oscars, and we're getting together tonight to talk about that. They're in what? A week and a half. March 10th.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll try and get this out before the Oscars. It'll be the value of this conversation is already fairly limited. But if I don't get it out before the Oscars, it will fall below zero. So I'll be sure to do that.
I assume you mean it's limited just because it's you and me talking about movies, and that
of course
that yes. alone puts it pretty low. Yeah,
we're just contributing to the mass. Chatter on the internet, which I think is important. Someone has to. Our listeners demand it, and you know, yeah. we live to serve them.
The time of year where movies are at an all-time high, you know, they're like everyone's mind is thinking about these movies that came out 12 to 14 months, you know, in the past 12 to 14 months. You know, everyone's going out to the theater seeing every movie that's out right now. It's really, this is the height of movie fandom on the calendar. You know, this is why we record in late February, you know.
Yeah, people have received the palate cleanser that is Madame Web after mm-hmm. it's been a very serious few months of movie watching for them, and they needed something to take their minds off of Auschwitz families and Osage massacres. And mm-hmm. if anything, I mean, we're grateful for Madame Web. Especially just for that.
I think it's a good place to start. I know we're going to talk about this year's Oscars, you know, for this podcast, but Madame Web's shot at the Oscars for next year. You got to assume it's the front runner at this point, right? I mean, there's nothing.
Sure.
Nothing I mean, else even released, really.
It was released very early in the year, of course, but that didn't stop yeah. Silence of the Lambs from like sweeping everything, which I assume that Madame Web will as well.
And I've heard, I can't remember which critic, but I do know someone said Madame Web is the Sony Extended Universe's version of Silence of the Lambs. So it's, you know, it's an apt comparison.
If I could name a single male actor in that movie, I would compliment them on their tucking. But that's the extent of my Madame Web knowledge. We've exhausted it.
Yeah.
In the theater when the trailers come up on more than one occasion. So we'll save that. We'll save that discussion for March of 2025. But right now, we don't really have an agenda for the 2024 Oscars. We've already done our best of 2023 podcast where we talked about several of the movies that have been nominated. I think all of the movies that we talked about were fairly heavily nominated. Well, May, December, not so much. I think the Oscars have been generally pretty good as far as in the last several years, as far as the movies that they are nominating winners. You know, I feel a little slightly differently about that, but I don't necessarily think, with maybe one exception, that any of like the 10 best nominees are bad. The best picture nominees, I think a lot of quite good, and a lot of them are at the very top of my list from last year. And yeah, I think they're really I think they're just generally pretty good. I think the 2018 I think was a pretty bad top 10, top 8, whatever, however many it was. But that's really like the last year that it's been pretty off. I feel like.
So a couple of weeks ago, when the day of the nomination drop, you know, we all remember where we were. But I texted you, being like, I would record a pod. I've got thoughts. And in the ensuing weeks, those thoughts have, you know, lessened or dulled or whatever. But
sure.
At the time, I do feel like my initial reaction was, I was like, I think we're all crazy. I think the internet is shockingly dumb in that this is a pretty good group of nominees, and like maybe the best group of Best Picture nominees in a number of years. Right. Like, I don't think there's a necessarily bad movie on this list. Whereas in previous years, not only are there bad movies, but then like the bad movies win Best Picture somehow more mm-hmm. times than not, you know, like I think it's just such a weird, like, there's an internet brain rot that has happened around the Oscars, which is already, like, having thoughts on the Oscars is in itself fairly stupid. You know, I recognize that, like, as a movie obsessive dork that I am, that, like, I care about the Oscars. But it's just, like, I think when there's a good year, we should recognize that, like, this is a pretty good year. Now, is it, like, a better movie year altogether than past years? No, but I think if, like, top to bottom, these 10 movies are probably the best we've had, I would say, of the, I don't know, however many years, you know, since I can remember off the top
of my head. Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, we talked in our best of podcast how I prefer 2021 to this, to 2023 as far as movie years and in this newest decade go. But these nominees are head and shoulders better than, they're like, there's no coda, which again,
it's insane.
Like sticking it's things up.
It's insane that won Best Picture. I just don't, it really is like a, what the fuck happened? Like what in the world? And I think it's to talk about this year's Oscars, I don't think this has really happened this year, but I do think the coda thing is a byproduct of the fact that, like, why did the Oscars happen in, like, late February, early March? Like, what are we doing? Like, make them the, like, second week of January? Like, who cares? Like, you know, that's like a whole other thing. We don't really have an agenda for this pod, so maybe we talk about it. But, you know, the whole Oscar schedule and the fanfare and the campaigning is something I don't really care about. But the, like, rewarding and, you know, ranking and nominating movies for, you know, what is the best is, like, just something I inherently care about for stupid reasons. So
yeah, everybody has that. Everybody who cares about movies, like, has that moment when they realize that this is fake. This is, yeah, they're wrong. They're making objectively bad decisions. Who in their right mind would actually think, say, King's Speech is a better movie than The Social Network, or several other movies that were nominated that year, or et cetera, et cetera. That was a big moment for me, where you can just see very clearly what their specific interests are, and they let decisions that would give them a lot of credit kind of just pass them by in favor of inoffensive nonsense.
Yeah, when it's perfect that you mentioned the King's Speech, because I was about to say, like, I imagine most people have, like, a formative year where you're, like, really getting into movies, and you're, like, really, like, becoming this, like, before Letterboxd existed, the Letterboxd type of nerd that we both are, and then you, like, watched all these movies, and you saw what's won Best Picture, and you watched those, and then there's, like, a reckoning where you're, like, wait, that's the best movie? And that happened to me in 2010. I remember I must have been probably a freshman in high school or the year before. And it was spring break and I didn't go anywhere. And I went to work with my dad one day for spring break. And one of his like coworkers had a bunch of bootlegs of all the Best Picture, like, nominees. And I remember in that single day I watched The Social Network for the first time, which was awesome. 127 Hours, which I enjoyed. And The Fighter, which I also enjoyed. And then I remember watching the Oscars and being like, wait, The King's Speech? And then I watched that movie, and it was like a true reckoning of, like, oh, okay, I see. And now I think, I imagine most people have that experience at some point in life.
Definitely, yeah. I think, like, since they have expanded to 10 nominees, there was... Like, you can fool yourself to, like, oh, right, these are better than they have in the past. You go back to, like, the year that Million Dollar Baby won. That's been coming up on all the Ringer podcasts I listen to lately a lot for some reason. Like, those are terrible nominees. And, like, 2008 when Slumdog Millionaire won, like, those were all utterly forgettable nominees. And then the following year, you get, like, Inglourious Basterds and District 9 and The Hurt Locker. And, like, those are just more interesting movies than... the unimpressive, forgettable, erased by history movies that just become a greater proportion of the Best Picture nominees when there were only five. So you can overlook when things like Theory of Everything and Imitation Game and just movies that don't make really much of an impact. You just get to like mix them in. Like I really only feel like there's one of those kinds of movies this year, and even that movie at least has a theoretical reason for existence other than to win awards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess that would be a good segue to talk about the 10 best picture noms.
Yes, if you've got the list in front of you, we can just do what we usually do and go your 10, my 10, and then when we both land on the same movie, we can briefly talk about it, although we have already talked about a lot of these movies.
So let me, can I ask a qualifying question? Are we ranking our preference of just these 10 movies, or like what should win best picture, or what will win? Like
personal preference, just because I don't really make a distinction between.
So my list, I have not seen Zone of Interest yet. You know, I've seen Madame Web 12 times in theaters, but yet to have seen Zone of Interest. So
it doesn't really click until that ninth time, at least is
yeah. What I've heard from people. Well, I don't know if you, yeah, the web, her web kind of connects them all, and it takes a couple of viewings to really trace those.
Sure, for the poster tags to really sink in. And then you get the, oh.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. I have seen Zone of Interest. Jonathan Glazer is a singular director that I guess Sexy Beast got some Oscar recognition back in like 2000. He only made four movies in like 24 years. He is not an Oscar director, you would think, most of the time, but typical Oscar interests of movies that are about the Holocaust, I think, helps him to break through in what is a very confrontational movie, Zone of Interest. We haven't talked about that yet, but it is about the commandant of Auschwitz and his family who lived of all places in a house directly abutting the walls of Auschwitz. And they have their nice little garden and their home with their cute five children. And they're just living this idyllic settler life, as they describe it. And the Oscar that it should absolutely win is for sound design, because while they're going about their lives, you just hear the constant thrum of like the industrial genocide happening like 100 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
And the score, which I don't believe was nominated by Mika Levy, who is, I think, pound for pound, like one of the best movie composers working in film these days. She previously worked with Glazer on Under the Skin. Her score is what I thought it reminded me of was the movie Mad God from last year, which was a stop motion animated like journey into steampunk hell. And what I thought the score reminded me of was that movie like churning up a gross monster that was like barfing into the machines that it had to barf into in Mad God to make these machines like churn up clones. And people have to see Mad God. It's an insane movie. But that's what that score sounded like. Like just a thing burping into life, and like every action that these Auschwitz commanders were taking, both in their jobs and then like cultivating their garden, was like making this machine go. That is not the kind of score that wins awards. This kind of scores that win awards are like Hans Zimmer, John Williams, that kind of stuff. But like as far as like a score that syncs perfectly with what's happening on screen, Michael Levy's Zone of Interest. That would be, yeah, that's in the middle of my list. But strong recommend to Zone of Interest. It's like it's about what it's about. But so it's not like a fun watch by any means, but it's an extremely impressive movie.
And maybe this is a spoiler, I don't know. Maybe it's post-credits. Does Jojo Rabbit make an appearance?
The Nazi commander and his wife, they do dance to a David Bowie song at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Clear homage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to pay homage to the greats.
You do, yes. I mean, there's only so many things you can do in Holocaust movies.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Glazer found found a way to do something new and, like, and as you say, pay his respects to the previous great movie about the Holocaust.
Okay. Should I go to my number nine?
Yes. Please do. Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to assume we have the same last place ranking here. My of all these Best Picture nominees, I think the worst is the film Maestro.
Hey, me too.
All right. Which, in fairness, I don't even think is that bad. I just don't think it's that good. That's really where I would come down on the movie. Like, I don't think it's atrocious. Again, go back to other Best Picture nominees throughout the years, and it's like, this would be pretty mid-tier compared to, like, again, your Codas and your Green Books or whatever the fuck else.
Bohemian Rhapsody. But,
yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's a movie that, like, I do think the... Here's what I, you know, I just watched Ferrari a couple, like a week or two ago, which I liked a lot. And I thought that movie, that, yeah, I think that movie does very well what Maestro does very poorly, which is the framing of the narrative of, like, if you're going to do a biopic about anyone's life over any number of time, span of time, I think the way, what span of time, what point in that person's life, what aspects of their life you choose to include is in some ways the most important part of any biopic. And I just think Maestro kind of fails utterly at that, where like a movie like Ferrari is like, we're going to tell you this like 2 month span of Ferrari's life that is in some ways pivotal, but more ways it's emblematic of who he was as a person. And Maestro just loses that completely. Like, I wasn't like a Bernstein aficionado going into the movie, and I feel like I know less about him coming out. Like, it's just and that's such a flaw, I think, because there is good stuff in the movie. Like, I think, like, you know, Bradley, I don't really have ill will till Brad. I think the internet, you know, sees him as more of a tryhard, which, like, I don't mind. I think he's a good actor out of, you know, other actors who try this type of stuff. Again, you're like your Rami Malek's of the world or whoever. Yeah, but I think his performance is good. I think Carey Mulligan is doing what she usually does. And I think there's like a scene or two in this movie that are really expertly crafted and directed. But the movie as a whole, just it has no sum to its parts, I would say. Like, it's just, yeah. And that's where I think you referenced earlier, it comes across as like a very, very wanting Oscar play. And yeah. I think that's the biggest in some ways, too.
It is, to borrow a phrase from Blank Check, sweaty. Not just yes. in
and the literally, actual
performance.
Literally, he's sweating.
Yes, he's extremely sweaty in all this makeup and prosthetics. But the movie itself is also very sweaty. In just like the choice of subject, how many boxes this movie ticks. As like it seems very algorithm-driven. I don't think it's an accident that it's made by Netflix or produced by Netflix or distributed, whatever. I learned more about Leonard Bernstein watching Tar than this movie. I don't know anything about this guy. I know very little. Why is he significant? That would have been a nice question for this movie to answer. A lot of these great man biopics cover up for that framing by making it about the marriage, which is something this movie very much does. But lots of people are married. And lots of people have interesting marriages. He's not exceptional. He's not getting a movie made about him because he had an interesting marriage. If he even did. I don't know that he did.
Yeah, that's debatable, I would say, after watching the movie.
Yeah.
But it's just, it is, I mean, I think, yeah, what you're saying, what other biopics, you know, it, almost as a trope, but do better, is like, there is some connection that the filmmaker or writer, whoever, makes between their personal life and whatever it is that they do, you know, their art, their, you know, we'll talk about another one later, their science, their creations. You are meant to kind of connect these figurative lines of like who they were behind, you know, behind the scenes versus who they were as a public figure. And I think there's no connection that I can clearly discern, because this movie doesn't really go out of its way to discuss who Leonard Bernstein was as an artist. We see him conducting, which I think is the best scene in the movie, but that scene feels like totally disjointed from the rest of it. Like, it feels copy and paste it out of a different
dialogue. Or what's the significance of it? It's supposedly like the greatest classical music event of the last 50 years or whatever. Why? Yeah.
And it comes into the movie with zero context. And then again, like the relationship he has with Carey Mulligan's character is implied to have impacted that in some way, or it has some impact on their relationship, but it just is not really understood or communicated in a good way. And so it's just, and then after seeing the movie, and this is maybe this is a bit, you know, the bad criticism is like saying like this movie wasn't a different thing, right? Like you don't order a cheeseburger and complain that it's pizza, you know, or whatever. But it does seem like after watching this movie, I was talking with my mother, who is a big Leonard Bernstein fan, and she was telling me like 12 more fascinating things about his life than anything in this movie that I would have loved to see. And I think that is ultimately like a weird failure in part too, because there's kind of this meta aspect to it where like Bradley Cooper is now on this real campaign, you know, to win an Oscar or just to promote this movie, where he's really talking up like Leonard Bernstein and his like admiration for him and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it almost is more embarrassing that it's like everything you're saying about Leonard Bernstein that you feel for him, it does not come across in this movie that you starred and directed in. So that's like a real bummer of a failure, I think. The biggest sin of the movie, and tell me if you caught this, it was very subtle, but there's a point towards the end where Bradley Cooper as Leonard Bernstein is driving a red Corvette and blaring the radio. And on the radio, what is playing? You guessed it. It is REM's End of the World as We Know It. And it is specifically the line where they shout Leonard Bernstein. That has to be one of the most atrocious things I'd seen in a movie this year. Last year. It's just so bad.
Yeah, we might top that as we go through this list.
Yeah, and, right. You know, there are a couple other on the nose moments, maybe. That is in the running for Oscar for most on the nose moment. And also speaking of noses, with this movie very on the nose, so to speak.
Blammo. Got him.
Got him. Take that, Bradley.
This is the only movie of these 10 that's in my C tier. Everything else is a B or better, which is quite good for an Oscar Best Picture lineup.
What I think we both agree Maestro would be out, you know, in our, if we ran the Oscars. What would be your next one in? What's on the bubble that Maestro beat out that you would put in?
Either Boy and the Heron or Spider-Verse would have been nice, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we're just keeping it with live action, All of Us Strangers is the next movie on my like personal top 10. I feel like that movie just came out too late, which is frequently a thing. So the next tier down would be May December or The Iron Claw. Iron Claw getting May December getting mostly overlooked, Iron Claw getting completely overlooked, which I think is as far as like the list of nominees, like what probably was 11 on their actual list was probably something like Naiad.
Yeah, I mean that's the sadder answer probably. May December is like the realistic answer, right? Of like what probably could have been nominated and wasn't. Naiad, I guess, is like I haven't seen that, and frankly, I don't plan on it. Yeah, I think Across the Spider-Verse is a fun answer there. That would be it. Okay, your number 8 you said was Barbie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is also my number 8. Yeah, sorry, it's also Barbie. So, I mean, this was the movie that really made me like the internet discourse just like drove me crazy for a day, and then Hillary Clinton tweeted about it and did hashtag Hillary Barbie, and my brain broke to the point where I couldn't care less. So I don't want to sound like, I want to preface by saying I like the movie Barbie. Like I'm not like, I feel like there's probably a misogynistic slant to people that don't like the movie. I don't recognize that. I'm not part of that. But I will say the quote unquote outrage over the nominations for Barbie has to be some of the most pea brain shit I've read about movies on the internet in quite some time. Like, it's just such stupid discourse. And so anyone who is complaining that Greta Gerwig did not get nominated over a list of five pretty great directors is stupid. I'll say it. And anyone who's complaining that, like, yeah, Margot Robbie, like, probably should have been nominated. Like, you know, if you look at Best Actress, like, does anyone really care about Annette Bening and NIAID? Like, no, right? But the discourse around it being that this is, like, a sexist or, you know, misogynistic, like, this you know, disregard for two great filmmakers who made a great movie, it's like, I think that's just such a simple-minded way to look at it, right? Like, it got 8 nominations, including Best Picture, which both Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig, like, were producers on it. The other Best Actress nominees are, like, pretty fucking good performances, if you ask me. It got a nomination for fucking America Ferrera. Like, what are we, like, what? Like, stupid. Like, so it's just, I just thought that was so stupid. To the point where it went to Hillary Clinton tweeting and Ryan Gosling tweeting. And if I can shit on one more person, whoever, I don't know her name, and I don't really care. Whoever wrote the, for the LA Times, did you read this piece the day after the nominations?
No.
I'll read you here an excerpt. Here's Mary McNamara is her name. She covers TV and film for LA Times. She wrote, "If only Barbie had done a little time as a sex worker, or barely survived becoming the next victim in a mass murder plot, or stood accused of shoving Ken out the Dreamhouse top window, then, like, you know, .. maybe she would have been nominated for an Oscar."
The Oscars have a long problem with recognizing comedies, but that's not why Hillary Clinton is tweeting about it, because she appreciates a good joke.
That would be awesome if it was, but it's not. But I just think that framing of this problem is so, frankly, more problematic than, like, the Oscars themselves. Like, being, like, a movie about a sex worker talking about Poor Things, or a mass genocide of indigenous people, like, as if those are like, something we're glorifying, or, like, that shouldn't be, or, like, it's just so...
Yeah, will no one pay attention to this billion-dollar box office winner who spent $500,000 on production and, or $500 million on production and marketing,
and
got all these other nominations, and is based off of one of the most recognized toys of all time, made by a major studio? Yeah. Like, this is what the money's for, meme.
Exactly. But, yeah. Yeah, so that was so all my thoughts aside on that, like, Frank, like, I think that's so stupid. I think I've made my point here, but to talk about the movie itself, I actually liked it. I thought it was, like, pretty okay. You know, it's pretty funny. I think we talked about it maybe on a previous podcast, or maybe it was just you and me before or after record. You know, I think it's, like, as a Barbie movie, it delivers way above average, right? Like, you're run of the mill, like, Mattel is forcing a movie about Barbie, probably, like, 99 out of 100 times it sucks, but Greta Gerwig directs it, and, you know, certain people get attached to it, like Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie, and it's pretty good. I think as a Greta Gerwig movie, I was a little underwhelmed, and I frankly would like her to make more movies like Little Women and Lady Bird, which I think are phenomenal, you know, A-plus movies. So, like, I liked it, but I wouldn't, you know, is it, like, should it win best? Would it ever win Best Picture in my book? No, you know, it shouldn't, nor would it. But the fact that it got nominated is fine with me. I don't think it's bad.
Yeah, I think, like, her two previous movies are, they just have so much care for everything that happens on screen. And I feel like a lot of stuff gets lost in Barbie. A lot, there's, like, extra stuff in Barbie that just makes the movie less of a complete package, like the stuff with the daughter. And I know what people like America Ferrera's speech. It's why she got nominated. I just think it doesn't belong in a movie. Like, it's bad. I feel like it's bad movie making, bad writing.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. is like, I wouldn't even say that that performance or that character was like not deserving of an Oscar nom, which it's not. I would say that was like the part of the movie I didn't like. I think you get a little glimpse of what a, like, again, like a stereotypical run-of-the-mill Barbie movie would be, which is anything that occurs in the real world when she goes, leaves Barbie Land and goes to the Ford Focus filled real world. And it's like a fish out of water who she doesn't know what, you know, a gynecologist is or whatever, right? It's like, that's what the standard Barbie movie is, what Greta Gerwig brought to it, that kind of like inventive comedic world of Barbie Land and the Busby Berkeley style musical stuff. Like, that stuff's really good, I think. And I just kind of wish it was a movie of that or something more like that. Yeah. So it's, yeah.
All the stuff with like the executives, I don't really have any sense of.
Yeah.
There's just too much happening. In the movie, like, it's overstuffed.
Understandably, like, pretty popular with teenagers, and obviously was like the biggest movie of the summer if you were a girl or not interested in Oppenheimer, I guess. And so I had a lot of students who were talking about this movie. We reviewed it for our student newspaper, and I keep recommending to students, like, I think if you like Barbie, if you have not seen Clueless, you should watch Clueless, because I think that movie delivers. You know, I definitely think there's a correlation between the two. But I think Clueless, what it does so well is that it is kind of unrelentingly in that world. Like, it never eases up. You never go to the real world. There's never serious. Like, it's just this world and this comedy, and every minute is a joke. And I think the Barbie has moments like that, especially when they're in Barbie Land, and especially when Ryan Gosling's on screen. But as a whole movie, it still ekes in like a, what is like a crappier version of the modern comedy big IP tentpole movie.
Yeah, fine. It's pretty good. It's a pretty good movie. That just not up to par for the person who made it. I feel like there is no one who would say this is not her worst movie. Even people that like Barbie.
Of those three, right? I can't remember. She doesn't have like that. Yeah. Yeah.
I think she's got like a co-directing credit.
Yeah. Right. That's from, with Joe Swanberg.
I haven't seen it. But like, of her three, like, of Lady Bird, Little Women, and Barbie, like, no one would say Barbie is anything but the third of those movies.
Yeah. I mean, let's see who actually listens to this podcast, but there's some people in our quote unquote club, our Discord server, who, if I recall, have some strong opinions on Lady Bird. So maybe.
You might be thinking of Frances Ha. People have strong opinions about Frances Ha.
Oh. Okay. Yeah.
She co-wrote and starred in, but did not direct.
Okay.
Lady Bird is, I feel like Lady Bird in the Media Community Club is universally beloved. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
What's your next movie?
So my number seven is my most recent watch of the Oscar noms, which is American Fiction.
Hey, me too.
Look at us. I think we're going to, we could actually, I know where we're going to differ, but for now we're on track. I liked American Fiction. I mean, I definitely have an interest in the subject matter. I think, you know, as an English teacher, this is something, in some ways, stuff I think about in my professional life. But I would say, it definitely is a good movie, good Oscar nom. Cord Jefferson, good to see that he got some recognition. I would say as a movie, its limitations come in the directing, where, like, compared to the six movies I have above it, those movies also are well-written, well-acted, you know, everything else, but also have some visual style to them that is more intriguing. This movie could have been broken up into, like, a six-part miniseries on Netflix or Apple or Amazon or anything, and it would have felt a piece, you know, which is not a knock against the movie, but it's a, as where I rank it in my best picture rankings, that comes into play, I guess. The subject matter is interesting, and I think what it does well is it is not just a movie about ideas, but also it's got characters, and those characters are living a life, and things are happening to them, and that it's not just a movie that is trying to espouse its idea, Cord Jefferson's ideas about the publishing world or whatever. I think it's based off a novel too. Is that right?
I don't know. I thought this was an original.
I thought it was based on a novel, but I thought it was original, and then I saw an article about some of the problems with the film, possibly, and its adaptation.
Oh, yeah, it is adapted screenplay.
Right. But so, you know, whatever. But I don't know. I liked it a lot, and I thought it was both funny. And again, like for the Oscars, like this movie's pretty funny. And I kind of agreed with its ultimate message in I don't know if everybody did, but I think the comparison of Jeffrey Wright's character as an author, you know, the conversation he ends up having, his character and Issa Rae's character, who is the kind of sensationalized, stereotypical black voice in literature and media of sensationalizing, you know, aspects of poverty or race or whatever. You know, I thought that's like an interesting idea that most, you know, again, for the Oscars, which like not that long ago, Green Book won, you know, to have American Fiction, which is essentially a movie being critical of that type of bullshit. It's good that that movie exists and it does a good job and it's funny and heartfelt at times.
Yeah. I'd agree with most of that. I feel like if this was an original screenplay, it would probably win. But because it's an adapted against Oppenheimer and I don't know about Barbie, probably not. Zone of Interest and Poor Things are the two movies in that category. So that's a pretty crazy category. Yeah. But that's certainly its best chance. Got nominated for Sterling K. Brown and Jeffrey Wright, both of whom are very good in the movie. I feel like this is two different movies, like uncomfortably smooshed together. Pretty compelling mm-hmm. family drama and this heightened workplace stuff.
Yeah.
And there's like a very discernible code or like a tone switching. When those two things are butting up against each other. I saw this movie pretty recently, but although I don't remember they don't really interact with each other very much. I don't feel like he has a conversation with his brother about what he's doing with his book, which is the person he would credibly mm-hmm. do that with, or the woman he starts dating.
Mm-hmm.
He just starts to get a little more and more irritable, and his negative qualities come out as he spends more time with these people. Right. But yeah, it's just different. Like the book part is about why can't we have just black characters say spending time at their vacation home with their ailing mother
exactly.
and dealing with their past interactions and how they're still wounded from their childhood, et cetera, et cetera. And then the movie gives that to you while it's lamenting this never happens. So I'm sure all that is very purposeful and
yes, that's what I was going to say. Worthy
me could make that argument as far as like why this movie is in fact not disjointed at all. That's just how it felt to me in that first viewing.
Right. So that was something I picked up on when I was watching too, was like the idea that I forget his character's name now, but Jeffrey Wright's character's
Monk.
Monk, that's right, Monk, yeah. The idea that Monk's character is kind of fighting for in the literary world is, it's exactly what you said. It's like, as I was watching it, I was like, this is a portrayal of what he's arguing, right? It's like, we are not, you know, black characters in film or whatever are not just, you know, thugs or drug dealers or slaves or used to be slaves and are now ghosts haunting their slave owners, but they are people with ailing mothers and uncontrollable brothers and new romances. And like that, I do think I get what you're saying, which is they do at times feel like kind of two different worlds and two different tones of like, you know, when he's doing the voice of the fake author he's portraying over the phone, it's like that is very comical. And then you go back to like what's going on with his mother and those feel very I could see that two very different movies. But it is exactly what we were saying is like it is portraying that he is a real person with real problems that are not stereotypical black movie character problems, possibly. But I agree with you that if this movie were to win anything, it would be that type of writing Oscar that, like, you know, I think The Big Picture says this a lot, or it's just commonly said of like the writing best original screenplay or adapted, I guess, but usually original is like the Cool Kids Club kind of like this is actually the best movie. And I could see this being in another year, the type of movie it might win. I think, I can't remember if it's projected to or not, but I guess Oppenheimer feels like the front runner, or am I misreading that? I don't know.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. But this would be the type of movie that if it were an original screenplay and it won, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's what that movie should win for. You know,
I was looking at what WGA gave.
Oh yeah.
But they don't have their ceremony is until April. Can that be right? Okay.
Why?
So
why April? Like, what are we doing?
I'm shocked. I guess because of the strike, but SAG just had their awards. Yeah. Not until April. Okay. So this is unprecedented. Okay. Yeah. Writing's a total toss up this year. My next movie is Past Lives, which I feel is where we're going to differ.
It is. Because
what's your next one?
My number six is Poor Things.
Okay. My next movie is Killers of the Flower Moon.
Ooh. Mine is Anatomy of a Fall.
All right. And then I go Zone of Interest.
And this is at number four is where I have Past Lives.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. It's totally possible that if I were to rewatch this movie, it would click more effectively. In the Mood for Love took me three times to really lock in as an A-plus all-timer movie. I'm not saying Past Lives is up to that level necessarily, but that I just have I have prior precedent of slow burn, melancholy romances taking some time with me. But just on that first viewing, I admired the acting, but had a and the contrivances of the specific scenario, but just didn't work on me as it clearly has for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about it on our year end podcast. It was my top five for that as well. And this is where earlier when I was prefacing, like, are we talking personal preference versus like Oscar, like what should or could win? This is where, like, I think my personal preference outweighs, you know, I think Anatomy of Fall and Poor Things, two movies I have below this, easily I could put above this and I would feel totally fine. You know, I think they're relatively on the same tier for me. Like, I think after American Fiction, there is maybe a jump in tier. So like, you know, for me, I just personally connected with it a little bit more. Anatomy of Fall, as time has gone on, and we'll talk about when we get there, you know, that movie is growing and growing every time I think about it. So it's a little like, if you asked me next week or last week, the answers could be different, you know.
Okay. My number four movie is Poor Things. Mm-hmm. Yorgos Lanthimos is I'm just locked into this guy. I love everything he does. As his movies have gotten more mainstream over the last decade, I feel like he's lost a tiny little step compared to things like Dogtooth and even his first English language movie, The Lobster. That's just a tiny bit stranger than The Favorite and Poor Things, although both of those movies are quite strange. But that tiny half step doesn't mean I still don't love these movies. Poor Things, like, it just looks incredible. It is very funny. You can't resist putting a crazy dance scene in one of his movies. They all have it. And each one is just delightful. this one is certainly the most understandable. It's like the Poor Things is... It's easy. It's easiest of his movies to wrap your head around. There's no question of like what's going to happen next. What does this movie mean about whatever? All that's fine. But it's just, I think it's so much fun. I think Emma Stone is fantastic. I think I love every time Willem Dafoe burps a giant gas bubble into the air. There's just so much to take, and like the Christopher Abbott coming in the last like 20 minutes and throwing in a new wrinkle, Margaret Qualley. It's a great cast. I love what he does. His movies work on me. Poor Things worked on me. Poor Things is great.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember. If we, I don't. I guess we didn't talk. I think I had just seen
we
this
didn't
last time we talked. I'll say this. I ended up liking the movie way more than I thought. The first 20 to 30 minutes was a real, my kind of question marks were up about, I was like, is this, it's a little tough to watch, I thought. And it was a little troubling to be like watching this woman with the mind of a child be exploited for sex and questioning that. But then to its testament, as the movie goes on, weirdly wins you over, won me over. Like, as it kept going, it made more sense to me, and it unfolded, and it was her, I think the primary part of that is that Emma Stone's performance is pretty phenomenal. I think she will win the Oscar, and we could talk about some other performances maybe that could compete for that, but I you know, I have no qualms with her winning. I think she's pretty great, and I think Mark Ruffalo is also, once he comes into the movie, it also gives it a little more life and a little more comedy. But there's definitely parts of this movie that I felt were very much, again, I think, you know, to borrow a phrase from one of our shared favorite podcasts, a bit Gapachka, you know, a little too, one thing too many or a couple things too many. Specifically, I think there's a stretch in the middle of the movie when Gerard Carmichael's character comes in and
the cruise ship.
Yeah, it's not just, it's when... You know, I think this movie really works when it's just about a woman discovering this, like, quote-unquote place in the world, right? And I think when it doesn't work is when it's her character talking with Gerard Carmichael's looking at, like, this depiction of human suffering and having to contemplate that as well. And I just feel like that was a very, like... One, I don't think he's a very good actor, at least for a movie like this. And two, I just thought it was a real... You're just telling me the ideas rather than like showing me or taking me along to form those ideas. Like that part of the movie is pretty tough, I would say. And so it's got a little detraction for that. And I do think it, like most Yorgos Lanthimos movies, I feel like it just goes on a little too long, a little too much, you know. Mm-hmm. But it won me over in a way that I was very surprised by. If you had asked me 20 minutes in, I would have said I do not like this and I'm troubled by it. But as it went on, it especially because of Emma Stone, it comes together very well.
I did see some very offended reviews of the in that vein, like this movie is about people exploiting a woman with the brain of a baby. Mm-hmm. Whatever. They throw in a line about how her brain is catching up so fast that it didn't bother me at all. Didn't bother me at all. I immediately overlooked that stuff. These are just the movies that he makes. Dogtooth is about incest.
Yeah.
Amongst many other things. That's just the way it is. But yeah, that part with Gerard Carmichael, I think of like Dogtooth and the Lobster as like these in-depth treatises about political theory in a lot of ways. Totalitarianism and revolution and counter-revolution. That's all subtext you can read in the movie. There's mm-hmm. very little subtext in Poor Things, if any at all.
Yeah.
I do love this movie, but it's pretty far away from Dogtooth and The Lobster for that reason. Just because it's not hiding anything.
No. Did you like the look of this movie?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I think the costuming and all that, like I don't know if it's supposed to win. I don't really pay attention to a lot of the
production. The same people that were upset about Margot Robbie not getting nominated were also upset about the Production Design Guild giving the win to Poor Things over Barbie. But I find that obvious. Like, that is
they're both good
choice.
Yeah. Yeah, the costumes and everything are pretty great. I think there's a weird CGI style to like some of it. It works and it doesn't, maybe. I don't know. To me, it's like, is a little more Guillermo del Toro than I would have liked, but maybe that's just my personal preference. A little Tim Burton-y at times, even, but which is not bad, but not my style, maybe.
For as little as I was able to get out of, like, what is this movie about? Am I having these, like, light bulb moments that I would occasionally get in, like, history classes in college, Didn't get any of those, but there's just so much happening within the frame and how he's shooting it and stuff in the background that it very much keeps me locked in. So you have three movies left.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Okay. So what's your next one?
So my number three is Oppenheimer.
Okay. We'll come back to that. My number three is Anatomy of a Fall. We've talked about this. It's good that we talked about this having so briefly, or having earlier talked about Maestro. Like, Maestro wants to like get out its big dramatic moment with its fight between Bernstein and his wife, which is fine. That's a totally fine argument scene. Anatomy of a Fall shames Bradley Cooper with the same scene. Like, he should hang his head. He should mournfully take off his fake nose after watching this movie and be like, damn, that's how you film and write a scene between two furious spouses.
It's a movie that just keeps growing in my estimation as I get to talk about it with other people, especially. And I think it's the type of movie that, like, when we talk about, like, at the beginning of this one, I was like, this is a good Oscars year, ultimately. It's movies like this getting recognized that's, like, and not just, like, a Best Picture nom, but, like, you know, other, you know, directing and acting and things like that. You know, The Dog is on the campaign trail. Like, that's
been the best PR of the whole season.
Yes. And I would say, too, like, if you look at the last couple of years of Best Picture noms, like, this is starting to become a trend. And I think it's because of the changing demographics of the Academy, probably, is that, like, there's now a little more space for international pictures every year. And the whole, like, whole other podcast could be about the, like, why do they separate foreign language films and why can only one from each country be not, like, that's kind of arbitrary, if you ask me. But it's like, if you look at the last couple of years of, like, your movies like your Triangles of Sadness, mm-hmm. or Don't Look Up, or not, sorry, Drive My Car, or things like that, or even, like, Zone of Interest this year as well, I would say this is, like, the best of that so far, of just, like, an international movie that maybe in previous years would have been just subjected to the international category, getting the Best Picture nom, and then, like, being an actually pretty great movie and getting a pretty good bump from it, I would imagine. Like, people actually watching this movie that wouldn't have watched it if it was just nominated for international feature or whatever.
And as far as like the, you know, Bong Joon-ho's 1-inch barrier of subtitles, you know, keeping people out of a much broader world of movies, et cetera, et cetera. Just a very beginner level entry into foreign films. Any American viewer would recognize this as a certain kind of movie and be as drawn in as if it is partly in English, but if the whole thing was in English, you would have to change very little. Totally recognizable to, like, the average viewer. It's not too pastoral, or it's not too literary as a lot of foreign movies are. A total potboiler with hot lawyers and and great fights between spices. Your number two, Pierce.
So my number two is The Holdovers.
As is mine. We talked about The Holdovers. Okay. Divine Joy Randolph seems like a shoo-in for supporting actress. I'd say that's certain. I feel like Paul Giamatti is like an outside chance.
Yeah, I think not anymore, but like, in, like, it's the type of thing where, like, I think he's gonna get more votes than anyone would think, but I don't think he wins. I like that this is your number two also, because this was the one that I really felt like when I looked at this list and I was like, well, Oppenheimer, I have ranked right below this, is, like, way more of a quote-unquote Oscars movie, and, like, will absolutely, I think, is just going to dominate and sweep and win everything it's nominated for, probably, and, like, et cetera. But, like, I just personally like The Holdovers more, you know, and it is nominated for stuff. It's not like this is some total dark horse of, like, a, you know, whatever. But Yeah, the performances are what may really make this movie, and I think they're like three of my favorite performances of the year. I think it's absolutely, if there's really one thing that didn't get nominated out of any category that I really think is like I would have fixed if I had my way, is the kid should be nominated. Sessa, what is it, Dominic? Mm-hmm. Dominic Sessa? Yeah. Yeah, I think he was my favorite performance of the entire year of any movie, any gender, whatever. And I just think, like, why? It didn't even seem like it was in contention for, like, supporting actor, which is, like, maybe it's a bit of a stacked category, but, like...
It really is. I'm looking at it now, and I don't know who you would...
I mean...
Maybe Ruffalo, just because of the comedy angle.
Yeah, I think of these performances, Sterling K. Brown, who I do like a lot in that movie, is, of these five performances here, would be the one I would really probably knock out.
He's got the smallest role of these five.
Yeah. But honestly, like, I get that, like, Robert Downey Jr. is probably going to win this, but, like, I don't know. I fucking like Dominic Sessa's performance better than his.
Sure.
So, it's a bit of a stacked category, sure. But I just think that's such a great performance. And Giamatti's great, and Devine is great, but, and the writing is, you know, I think I talked about it in our year-end pod. I just think this is my favorite written, you know, piece of writing, and it's just my type of movie. It's the classic. They don't make them like this anymore movies. Mm-hmm. And I just loved it. So I, you know, in a better world, this would be like maybe in contention for best picture. I totally understand why it's not, but, Divine Joy and Randolph winning is great. If Giamatti wins, that'd be amazing.
I think that's maybe the best thing that could happen.
Yeah.
Like if he were to win, I think that would be the best decision. Like, I'm a member of the Unspooled podcast Facebook group, mm-hmm. and they like put out a Google Doc, like vote for your own Oscars. And he was my choice for best actor.
Yeah.
Amongst everybody, not like who was nominated for, you know, like you could have voted for anybody. And like, it was him. He is my favorite male lead performance last year.
Yeah. Would you say you like him better than Colman Domingo and Rustin? Have you seen Rustin?
Well, we could take a sidetrack into Rustin.
I don't know anything really about that movie, and I haven't seen it. I just think that is that and the Naiad performances are your classic Oscars, like, huh? Like what? Like nobody.
I think of that movie as like this is a take your vitamins movie, Netflix produced, from the guy who made Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which I liked for Viola Davis. But that was it. I thought that was pretty clearly a play, and everyone was acting as if it was a play, except for Viola Davis, who was like playing it. I felt the smallest of everybody in the cast. I'm not interested in Rustin at all.
I did not like
that movie's direction, and it didn't get good enough reviews. It got exactly what I expected. It like 3 stars on Roger Ebert, 70s on Metacritic. That's just like, that's exactly where I figured it would land. Like, yeah, this movie is fine. And part of that fine is, how can I write a review that says I didn't enjoy this movie or find it necessary in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah. I just read the synopsis of what that movie's about. Didn't know it was about a civil rights activist. But I will say that it does seem like that and the NIAID nominations fall distinctly in line with, you know, your Renee Zellweger for
Judy.
Yes. And, you know, The Eyes of Tammy Faye and The Theory of Everything. Like, just these, that's a bigger movie, maybe that last one. But it's just that thing of, like, biopics in which actors, you know, it's a biopic about a great person that nobody watched, but the performance is really great, and so it gets a nomination when, like, I don't know, actor in a leading role, like, we'll talk about, but, like, I think, I was talking about this the other day with somebody, I think in, like, 5 years to do that, not to do the rewatchables thing, but, like, in 5 years, we're gonna look back and be like, why didn't Leonardo DiCaprio get nominated for this? Like, what? Like, you know, it just seems like there's other performances maybe, but, like, for me, it's just, like, nobody, and it's just, it's so telling, you know, in 5 years, nobody's going to be thinking about Colman Domingo and Rustin. Nobody's going to be thinking about Annette Bening and Naiad. It's just that that's like to see it happening in real time is always funny to me.
There is a sense that like he's been on a roll lately, Colman Domingo.
I like him. And he's doing the press tour and he's doing the, you know, he looks great on the red carpets and whatnot. But it's just the thing of like, this movie didn't exist before the Oscars, started happening and the campaign started happening. And now it won't exist once the Oscars are done, frankly.
Yeah.
Naiad is the bigger example of that, maybe.
Him going into this, very serious kind of performance, this, like, semi-transparent maestro type performance where like if he had got like a best supporting actor for something like Zola, 100%, that all sounds great. Give that to him, absolutely. But this is just not as interesting as that. Okay, so your number one then is Killers of the Flower Moon.
Absolutely.
I just last week I wrote a review on MiracleMovie.club and I then listened to all of my dozen film podcasts about Killers of the Flower Moon. And I mean, yeah, I'm in the minority. Like I went down while I was writing the review, and if I watched it again, which I might, I don't know, I might bump that B to a B+, but I just feel like the movie fails to convey any real love between Molly and Ernest. And I really think that's the key to the movie. And a lot of the podcasts I listen to, your film spottings, your film cast, your big picture, et cetera, et cetera. They came down almost uniformly that yes, it did. And I just didn't feel it. And that seems like a fatal flaw in the movie. And that's like what I told you about. Like this movie has two goals. It cannot do the Scorsese thing where any of these guys look appealing in what they're doing. And he achieves that by making them the dumbest pieces of shit who ever existed. But at the same time, why is Molly, who the film has infinite reservoirs of respect for, falling in love with and staying with this worst piece of shit ever? And I just didn't feel like it reconciled those two things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we talked about this when we did the year in pod, but I don't know. For me,
I would be convinced by all the podcasts I listened to, and I just wasn't.
Yeah. No, I get what you are saying. I would say that did not detract in my watching. But as far as my, like, if I could give out the best picture to any movie, this is what I would give it to thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it is a combination of subject matter and filmmaking and performance and, you know, everything that I think kind of matters when you think about what's the best picture of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this movie culminates all those things. Which is to say, like, it probably won't win really any Oscars, maybe.
It's totally possible. Like 0 for 10. That's not the first time this happened to Scorsese in the last, like, 15 years. Like, since The Departed.
Yeah.
And feel would, like, you know, if you're an Oscar voter, if you're, like, an en masse Oscar voter, you gave him his prize for, like, his 12th best movie. And you don't have to think about him ever again.
12th best movie. Jesus.
I think that's totally reasonable. I think I'm being generous, if anything.
All right. My microchips. That's fine. Microprocessors. didn't think we had a Navy. Okay. If it doesn't win anything, like, this is like a perfect example of like, this is when I don't care about the Oscars. It's like, there's so many great movies that don't win Oscars. And I think it was it's ironic. Spike Lee, I think, said this, but he said it about Black Klansman, which is like a movie I didn't really like. But, you know, his point was that like the Oscars, Spike Lee doesn't need an Oscar. The Oscars need Spike Lee. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie, is like, this movie is a success for me, whether it wins Best Picture or not. It doesn't need that, you know? But I don't know, like Lily Gladstone, if she won Best Actress, which is in play, I think before, like, I think there was a stretch in the last, you know, in this like 3 month Oscars cycle where I would have thought that was going to happen. But now it seems, I feel fairly confident with the success of Poor Things, it will be Emma Stone. But like if Lily Gladstone won for her performance, I think that'd be phenomenal. Like I said, I think like Robert De Niro is pretty great. Scorsese, I obviously have endless love for. Let me throw this at you, okay? The last 10 years, right? Here's Leo's last 10 years. Not to go all Bill Simmons on you, but
yeah,
here's Leo's last 10 years. Just movies. He does The Wolf of Wall Street in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Should have won.
The Rep. Say again.
Should have won for the Wolf of Wall Street.
Right. So then he does The Revenant in 2015. Does win.
Not for me.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Sure.
Don't Look Up, which...
Whatever.
Know, whatever. And then he does Killers of the Flower Moon. In 10 years, are we going to look back and be like, remember Leonardo DiCaprio, one of our great actors? What did he win his Oscar for? Oh, it was The Revenant. Not Wolf of Wall Street, not Once Upon a Time, not Killers of the Flower Moon. Which I think those
are
like
three... That's just the way these things are set up. Like, people never win for their best work.
Exactly. But I just think it's like, again, in real time, we can like watch this happen. It's like... Once Upon a Time, I think, is it really going to be the one we look back on and go, yeah, why didn't he win for that? Like, that was really great. But I think...
Yeah, and like before Wolf of Wall Street, he's in Django Unchained, which he could have credibly won for that, too.
Yeah, that's the weirdest one, because Christoph Waltz wins in 2 years in a row for basically a very similar, you know, a worse performance than Inglourious Basterds, frankly. But it's just that thing of, like, these three movies are great. Wolf of Wall Street, Once Upon a Time, and Killers. And he's not going to win for any, and we're not even talking about him not being nominated. Instead, we're talking about Margot Robbie. But it's just like, I don't know. For me, that's the performance that I look at for leading actor, and I'm just like, yeah, why would he not be in the discussion? And I just think in 10 years, we're going to look back and be like, Leo was really on something outside of Don't Look Up. You know, even The Revenant's not bad. It's just like not his best movie. But it's just like, yeah,
that's a Bradley Cooper maestro performance. He was very thirsty.
That's better, I guess.
I mean, he
it's less Oscar
ate liver or whatever he ate, but that was the story of that campaign. Was like, I really did all that stuff.
Yeah,
I was just having this conversation about like the movie Challengers that's coming out. Like, supposedly Zendaya isn't an accurate tennis player. I don't give a shit. I don't care about that. I don't care about that at all. That movie, like, I get the little tinkles when the trailer comes on. It's a great trailer. I get what I want from movies from that trailer. I'm excited to see that movie. I love Luca Guadagnino. And if he didn't hire the right tennis pro to teach Zendaya how to play tennis, I'd give a fuck. Yeah. I don't care about if he really ate the liver or not in The Revenant. But like that is so often how you win these awards. And like the comparison popped into my head was like Natalie Portman in Black Swan, and like the controversy over whether she did or didn't do the ballet in Black Swan. Who gives a shit? Like, give her the Oscar because she looked panicked while she was pulling a fake swan feather out of her shoulder. That's why I love that movie.
Yeah. But then
just on point super, super well.
I do think there are times. Like so for example, not to go off on too big a tangent with this, but for example, though, like the year Rami Malek wins for Bohemian Rhapsody.
Mm-hmm.
I look back at that and I'm like, well, Bradley Cooper, not that like it's just that he actually did the singing, but it's like that was part of the whole performance, you know, for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the type of Oscar thing where I do look back and go, give it to fucking Bradley Cooper for that, not Rami Malek, who didn't even do the singing. Like, I don't know. I put some weight in that, but I get what you're saying, which is like, yeah, I don't care if you're accurately playing tennis or whatever, or actually ate the
Bradley Cooper. The Star Is Born because he sure crushes those oxys with his boot heel, and he sure looked drunk when he pissed his pants on the stage or whatever he did.
Yeah,
the singing, whatever people. Okay. I don't really care. That's the kind of thing where they do the work or not. Did the actor go to boot camp to play in this war movie? Like, that shit's all fake. Who gives a fuck?
True. Very true.
Anyways.
Well, Killers of the Flower Moon, my favorite movie of the year, and
Totally fair.
Right, I think it's company. The best picture.
Yeah. Oppenheimer remains my favorite movie of the year. It's my number one. Should win. Will win. Yeah. I just said people never get awarded for their best work. I think that's not going to be the case this year. I think Oppenheimer is far and away Christopher Nolan's best movie. I think he's likely to win for best director, and he's likely to, and is he must be a producer on this. He is, yes. Yeah. And he's like another Oscar for Oppenheimer in best picture as well. And that's all well and good. That's fine. Like, it's not going to be necessarily surprising. You nailed it, Oscars. You did good. If that's the thing that happens.
Oppenheimer is a good movie. I don't think I had as deep an interest or a personal connection to it as you or others, maybe.
Yeah, I'm one.
I liked it. I think for me, the biggest draw of it was the filmmaking stuff. You know, the sequence of the bomb going off and stuff like that. Sure. I like the way he makes movies. Like, not necessarily the non-linear time stuff. Like, that usually is too much for me, with some movies. But, like, I just think, I've said this before, but, like, he just knows how to make a movie look fucking good. I think this has kind of been the conversation with Denis Villeneuve, with Dune 2 coming out. I think there's a short list of other directors who make movies on such a scale that just look real and practical, whether they are or aren't, I don't care. The way it looks is good. And just, he knows how to make a sequence and build tension. And I don't know, like, that's what I like about him. Less like the galaxy brained ideas of like a Tenet or Inception or whatever.
Oh yeah. Tenet is back in theaters this week, and I'm seeing a lot of like reevaluation of this movie. I'm like, what are you people fucking talking about?
I hated it. I really did.
Yeah.
Like, I just thought it was
gobbledygook. This is, you're being contrary. Like, this is not real. It cannot be real, what you're saying, that you like this movie.
Yeah. I would say
it's wrong. Like, no. Exactly the right thing happened to Tenet, which was like, I lost in the pandemic. Fine and good. That movie is bad.
I agree with this. I agree with this 100%. I would say, like, for me, like, I liked Oppenheimer. I think I like Dunkirk more, even. But for similar reasons, like, I like both of them as like him forcing himself to be grounded in the type of movie he's making. But yeah, I mean, I think there's something funny here that like Oppenheimer. So it's probably I don't know what the betting odds are on this, but I would say a safe bet. If any listeners have some disposable income, I wonder what the parlay is for. So Oppenheimer Best Picture seems like a lock. I think Christopher Nolan Best Director feels like a lock. I think Cillian Murphy Best Actor is pretty lock. Maybe Giamatti is a dark horse there, but I don't think so. And then writing, it's adapted screenplay. I think it definitely could win. And then just the irony.
I just have no idea. Like, I need my cheat of like the guild giving their award first, and that just didn't happen this year.
Yeah. You've got cinematography, which it feels like that's probably, it's got to be the front runner. Hoytema. But I just think there's some irony to, like, it would be the first movie to win the Big Five since, like, Silence of the Lambs or whatever did it last. But it just doesn't have a lead actress win. That's then very on-brand.
Dunn is not going to win supporting actress. Yeah. Like, there's no chance of that.
No, and nor do I think she's good in the movie. Yeah, I just don't. Fine. I'm not like, fine. Yeah, I wouldn't say that she should win over. That category really stinks besides Divine Joy Randolph and Emily Blunt. But it's just fine. It's just such a Christopher Nolan thing to be like, yeah, not getting a lead actress nomination for a character, not having a lead act, you know, his whole portrayal of writing and directing women is, that's funny to me. But it's going to sweep. It's going to win the most Oscars. I'm not going to be upset about it, and I don't think anyone should. And maybe some members of our Discord server might be. They're not here to defend their takes, but I don't totally understand their complaints. But yeah, I think it's a pretty good movie.
Yes. The member you're talking about gets one every 10 years, where he's just like out on a limb, out on his own. To his credit, like, he really sticks to it. But yeah. Fury Road was his last one, and now Oppenheimer. But whatever, I feel like he's in better company with people, so there are people out there who don't like Oppenheimer. It's not like a universally beloved.
Yeah. We talked about it in the year in pod. Like, there are parts of Oppenheimer that I think
sure, are not like you're
by any means, but like the, yeah,
the Leonard whole, Bernstein REM moment is like, is the JFK thing. And
yeah.
Yeah. It's bad. It's indefensible. Yeah,
that's pretty tough. But I think that whole section of the movie is just a little too drawn out. And really, if I look back on it, I'm probably going to rewatch Oppenheimer before the Oscars. I've only seen it the one time in theaters. And so I'd like to go back and watch those scenes and maybe think about them some more. But like, yeah, the Robert Downey Jr. stuff is a lot of the movie from what I recall. And I didn't love it as much. Mm-hmm. I just think the movie is just humming on such a high level when they are in, what's the name of the town they build?
Los Alamos.
Los Alamos, right? Like, I think that is the opening of the movie where it's, and I really, like, again, like, that's what I like about Nolan's film sometimes is, like, that just, the way he kind of montage, the whole first however long of the movie is just basically a montage of, like, his early life, and there's just a score underneath the whole thing, and it's constantly cutting. And then once they get to Los Alamos, I'm like, this is the movie, this is really fucking good. And then when it cuts away to the Robert Downey Jr. stuff, it's a little less good. And then I like him being Oppenheimer, Cillian Murphy being interrogated by Jason Clarke. Like, that stuff is good too. So it really is just that there's like a weaker leg to the movie, which is still fine. I still think it's a good movie.
That's all fair. So we've talked about a lot of the other categories as we've gone on. You mentioned you hadn't seen The Color Purple. I do like Danielle Brooks a lot in that movie. Like, between Color Purple and Wonka, both movies that I liked Color Purple better, but I like both of them fine. A C plus and a B, I think, is what I gave them.
Yeah.
I just don't remember any song from either of those movies, which I feel like is a big failure for a musical.
Yeah.
Compared to something like Barbie, where you do remember the songs. You can't watch a musical and not remember the songs. Like, a day later, that's kind of a failure. But like, she's I would say like the biggest character in the movie, like the brassiest character in the movie, so she certainly pops the most. And I haven't seen the the Steven Spielberg version, so this was all new to me.
So let me ask.
I've liked her since Orange is the New Black is like a foundational TV series for me, so I've always been a fan of Danielle Brooks, and I'm happy to see her get the recognition. Yes. Here,
let me ask two things. One, of the Best Picture nominees, let's say something happens, magical situation, mm-hmm. Oppenheimer's not going to win for whatever reason. What do you think is the number two? Do you think, you know, it's tough to say, I guess, in a year that feels so predetermined, but is there, if you got to see the votes, and I know they do a whole ranked choice voting nonsense, what do you think would be is number two or will be?
I think it's not Killers of the Flower Moon because mm-hmm. of the Apple stuff. I do think that Oscar voters are broadly resentful of Netflix and Apple more and more so. Somehow Coda snuck in there despite
that. That's what I was going to say.
But Coda and Killers of the Flower Moon are polar opposites of movies. So mm-hmm. I don't really have that's very strange to me. But I do think all that plays into what does and doesn't get votes for the same reason that like Maestro is going to be creeping up there because it is a Netflix thing. I feel like The Zone of Interest has like an outside shot, truly.
See, that's how I felt a little about Anatomy of a Fall. Which, like, I don't know if it's necessarily, like, the number two movie or on anyone's ballot, but I think it would be in the upper 50% of everyone's ballot, which you couldn't say about any other movie, maybe, besides mm-hmm. Oppenheimer. You know, like, I don't know if, like, maybe Killers of the Flower Moon, again, yeah, the Apple stuff is confusing, and Netflix is... Because it's, again, it's like, what, well, so fucking Coda gets to win, but, like...
I mean, we've all read those...
Yeah,
Oscar voter
idiots
yeah. articles, and like, yeah, they're dumb as a group.
You're right
for the most part. Yeah. And like, asking them to watch a 3.5-hour movie is a big ask for these people. Yeah. I mean, Oppenheimer is not that much shorter, but I don't know.
Yeah. I think I'm just formulating this take now, but I think it is a bit of a testament to this group of movies that there is not, there's obviously Oppenheimer is, I think, the front runner by far. But then below that is not like a, and then there's a couple good movies, and then there's a bunch of crap that like shouldn't win. Like, it's like any of these movies, you could kind of make an argument to me, maybe besides Maestro, although like for the Oscars, that wouldn't be shocking, I guess. But like, you could make an argument for most of these movies and I would buy it. Whereas like, you know, looking at 2022, like, I don't think there's a world where like Elvis should win Best Picture. I don't think there's a world where like Women Talking or even Triangle of Sadness, like, I don't know. There's just every year there's a couple of movies that I'm like, I don't see a path where it would ever be why, like, you know, where I would ever understand that movie winning. Mm. But every movie on here, I could see winning and make sense in some realm besides maybe Maestro. Yeah.
I would love for the answer to be Holdovers, but it didn't get the Best Director nomination, which I feel like is vital. But whereas Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest did. And as well as Poor Things.
Mm-hmm.
So like the knock is like those are the real five Best Picture nominees. But it's not like nothing's ever, like, again, Coda won despite not being nominated for Best Director. And there's been others. I think
famously Green Book
did get nominated for Best Director, strangely enough.
Great. Argo is the big one, right? Ben Affleck, yeah.
Yeah, it's not impossible.
Yeah. This is not the year, though. So then my other question, is there any other category or performance or nominee that you are like, I know you mentioned Paul Giamatti earlier, but is there any other nominee that you're like, I want this to win, whether it is going to win or not, like, it would bring you the most joy if it won?
May December winning for original screenplay would be fantastic. Todd Haynes didn't write that, which is surprising. I guess I don't know what his track record is as far as writing his own movies. I guess maybe he's not the one to do that. That really, May December really stands out as the movie that got that could have very easily been heavily nominated and maybe only got that.
Yeah, it's only I think it's still the only, maybe just the one. I don't know. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, May December is kind of like I said, like that's probably the biggest bubble movie that got left out in most categories, which, you know, I liked it a lot, but it's not like I'm not tweeting like Hillary Clinton that it should be nominated. I'm looking
at as far as in like other, like there's a few, like the Zone of Interest simply had the best sound. It is the correct winner. Therefore it must win. So that feels, that would be like a ratification of, can these people watch movies or not? I don't exactly know how the below the line voting works. I think everybody votes for everything. I'm not 100% certain about that. And like for best visual effects, like it just seems obvious that the cheapest movie should be the winner, which in this case is Godzilla Minus One. Like, is it so impressive that that Guardians of the Galaxy 3 with its like $250 million budget has good visual effects? Which does it? That's another question. Yeah. But Godzilla Minus One that costs like $20 million.
Yeah.
It should obviously win. And this is like the same thing with Ex Machina when it won. Like the smallest movie I feel should win. And if not that, then like The Creator, which has a lot of, which is not a perfect movie by any means, but it looks great.
Have we talked about that movie?
I don't think so.
Okay, maybe that's another pod, because I'm fascinated by that fucking movie. I didn't think about this until you brought this up, but yeah, Godzilla Minus One winning for visual effects. I thought that was I assumed that Oppenheimer was in there and was going to win that, which is very funny that it's not, because like, it just seems like they should change the name of that award to like best use of CGI, because like, why is Guardians of the Galaxy nominated? Right. Like, so, and like Napoleon also is a funny one. But if Godzilla Minus One wins for that, that would be I would consider the night a win. You know, like that's sick. That'd be awesome. I don't know if it will. I'm not really sure what the front runner is there. Do the Marvel movies have a good track record with that? I don't think
I
so.
I don't think so.
I don't know. Maybe Mission Impossible. I don't know what the front runner would be there, but
there's like the meta narrative there too of like how many people's jobs were supported by this movie. I do think that comes into play for like these Oscar voters. Like when you watch the credits of these movies and like the scroll is going for a minute of just like visual effects artists, like just all the money that gets spread around the industry because of it. I'm sure that's relevant.
Yeah.
To like vote totals.
Yeah. I mean, Oscar winning film Mission Impossible : directing part one is, I like that as a title. I was looking at the other nominees. There's none that I'm deeply passionate about. Like you said, like Giamatti winning would be sick as just a win for dudes who look like us, kind of. The Godzilla minus one for visual effects is now what I'm rooting for most. Animated feature, like Boy and the Heron, I liked a lot, and Hayao Miyazaki getting another Oscar would be cool. But I also really like Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
That's a total coin flip. Like Spider-Verse won the Annie Award, but the Boy and the Heron won the BAFTA. So
yeah,
it's really either one. Like worst case scenario, something like Elemental wins or Nimona.
I was about to say.
Haven't seen Nimona. Maybe it's fine. I don't know. They generally do pretty well nominating movies in Best Animated Feature. But that would obviously be the lazy choice and the wrong choice compared to. It seems possible, but boy, that would be funny. Frustrating.
It would be funny when Elemental wins the movie about a fire and water fucking or something. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
It's bad. It's not a good movie. International feature film, another one they typically do pretty well in. I've seen two of these movies. I've had the ability to see all five of these movies in Atlanta over the last month or two. And Perfect Days and El Capitano are playing in theaters the week that we're recording and maybe for another week after. I'm very interested in Perfect Days. And El Capitano is directed by Matteo Garrone, who is a great director and made Gamora and several other movies in that same vein. And I've liked a lot of his work. But, I mean, if a movie gets nominated for Best Picture, it's obviously going to win Best International Feature Film, so Zone of Interest, which again is fine. Yeah. And like when our current movie trio is like down ballot Oscar nominations. So and we picked Sight of the Snow, which I was really underwhelmed by, and The Eternal Ring. Sorry?
That movie's picked up. No, it's just Sight of the Snow seems to be the one that has like picked up the most steam. Like it's just like on Netflix and people are watching it. Like I hear people talking about it. And if Zone of Interest wasn't nominated there, which again is like a kind of weird thing that it even is because it's in Best Picture, you know, like why isn't Anatomy of a Fall? I don't know, whatever. But
I think it's just what they submitted. Yes,
that's so weak. Okay, whatever. If Zone of Interest wasn't there, I would say Society of the Snow feels like the one with the juice, so to speak. But it seems like Zone of Interest, yeah.
I feel I haven't seen Perfect Days yet. I feel like there is no way it's not at least very good. Like a legendary director. Whereas Society of the Snow, like J.A. Bayona was last seen directing Jurassic Park 2 or Jurassic
What's
World.
What's the subtitle?
The Lost Kingdom? The Lost Kingdom?
That's the original.
Fallen Kingdom.
Fallen Kingdom. Also, did he direct that one or the third? I thought he did the third one, which was even more forgettable.
No. They gave it back to Trevorrow.
Oh, they did? What was the subtitle of that one?
Everyone thought this was the right thing to do.
Jurassic World Dominion.
You know what I didn't get from Society of the Snow is, and we're going to podcast about this in like a week or two, I didn't get enough body horror in Society of the Snow. Like that movie, the reason that anybody remembers this incident is because the survivors were forced to eat the dead. And the process of that and the reception of it afterwards is what I was most interested in coming to that movie. And the movie is not interested in that at all. It's just a straightforward survivor story, which I don't really get very much out of. Go ahead.
For for a dollar, what is Chris Pratt's character's name in the Jurassic World films?
No idea. I know Owen Grady. Who is his pet raptor, who I'm sure saves a day in each of the movies, respectively.
Yep. I was just looking at the IMDb of Jurassic World Dominion. What a shit show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, well, short film categories, I do like those. I do go to see those when they're released in movies, or when they're released in theaters. And then I try and like watch the shorts on my own, because they don't release the documentary shorts in theaters alongside the animated shorts and live action shorts. I think Wes Anderson is nominated for a live action short film. I haven't seen any of his of four shorts that he released on Netflix, but I've heard fantastic things about all.
Yeah, I didn't watch any of them either. I don't know why. I have no reason. I like his movies. I didn't watch those. Yeah.
Animated shorts. I have seen the last two batches of those, and I haven't seen this current batch, but I've seen the last two batches in theaters. And they picked my least favorite both times, including last year, when the winner was, I want to say, like an adaptation of a children's book produced by Apple.
Yeah.
That was one of the worst pieces of shit I've ever seen in my entire life. Like Last Airbender level F. Awful. Like openly scoffing in the movie theater as this fucking interminable piece of shit just continues. And I know exactly why it won. It won because it had Apple marketing behind it, because it had a star, like a professional voice cast of known actors. And meanwhile, like the actual artistic achievements of like some grad student working at a computer for 6 months to make a movie, if not longer, somehow he gets nominated, she gets nominated. And like, that's such that's so clearly a better story for the Oscars, a better moment. And not to mention like the artistic quality of the movie, which is just better in every conceivable level. And they gave it to that fucking piece of shit.
It's
deeply depressing to see these categories get. I mean, good for Wes Anderson for probably winning an Oscar. So, yeah, this will be his first Oscar. But at the same time, I really feel like these categories, these are like supposed to be like amateur Olympic athletes.
Yeah.
Kind of how I think about it. Like these are supposed to be stepping stones for artists to like audition for the next part of their career. This is not like Jared Hess, the director of Napoleon Dynamite and Gentleman Broncos, is nominated for animated short film. And just because he's a recognizable name, if you're making an Oscar ballot, like that's probably the one you pick. And that's just depressing.
Yeah. I Googled this and I expected last year's winner to be some like, I don't know, really corporatized looking bullshit. And it's just The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, and The Horse. And it looks so sweet and innocent. And you called it the biggest piece of shit you've ever
seen. It's not that. It is the most cynical. It's so cynical. It's Liam Neeson reading Hallmark cards.
Yeah.
It was infuriating. And that, and like really, and there were My Year of Dicks in a world where like Pen 15 and Sex Education and Big Mouth exist, like this is just like the next logical thing. That was great. They could have announced, and the winner is My Year of Dicks at the Oscars. That wouldn't have been my pick to win, but it certainly, that would have been good. That would have been deserving. But instead, this is like Apple produced abomination. Oof.
Yeah.
Anything else? Anything else, Pierce?
Not really. There's not that, like, again, like, I like all of these movies, but there's nothing that I'm like, man, I'm really rooting for. You know, there's stuff that would be nice to see win, but this year it feels very chalk in many categories. So there's nothing, you know, nothing too like upset. I don't really expect any upsets, really. Hopefully I'm wrong, and that way it's the telecast is maybe interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch at least. And like, I'm thinking at like Best Original Song nominees. They could have nominated that kid song from Asteroid City. That would have been fun.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But
that
seemed possible. It was on the short list.
Yeah, but this may be a good note to end on. Much like Spike Lee, that kid song from Asteroid City does not need the Oscars. The Oscars need that kid song from
Exactly. Like,
yeah.
Last year had the RRR song to like liven things up, and there's usually like one, at least one
performance. Well, this year we've got Barbie.
Song that's like worth mentioning, like Lady Gaga. She's been nominated multiple times, and like every time she performs a song, like that becomes like the viral moment. And the John Legend Common song from Selma, Chris Pine crying, all that stuff. It'll undoubtedly be I'm Just Ken from this year. Like that'll be fun, presumably. But I don't know what the rest of these songs are. I don't remember the Billie Eilish song, which is probably going to win from Barbie, really. I guess that happened in like the last montage when, my patience with that movie was kind of running out. But yeah, The Fire Inside for Flamin' Hot.
That's awesome. If that wins, that's awesome.
If they can like pass out Cheetos to the audience while that's happening, like that'd be something. I don't know. I don't produce the Oscars, but whoever does tends to have uniformly bad ideas. So you got to do something. That is the 96th Oscar nominees.
Final question. How many people will Will Smith slap at this year's Oscars? Over under one.
I mean, yeah, who's going to get it?
Who's going to get it? Who deserves it? Who should get slapped?
Zendaya, like Pete Sampras is going to stop on stage. Like, you didn't get the forehand right in Challengers. I've seen a sneak preview. How dare you?
Yeah. I think Hillary Clinton will come on stage and slap Christopher Nolan for Women Everywhere. That would be the Oscars I want to see.
Yeah, get her a front row seat.
We can end this. This is insane.
I mean, she's got to stay relevant. What better way than to stick up for billion dollar grossing movie? It needs her support. As I previously mentioned, we'll be back shortly with our next podcast about Oscar down ballot movies, Sight of the Snow, and documentaries, The Eternal Memory and Four Daughters. Eternal Memory didn't really do much for me. It's an Alzheimer's documentary, which, frankly, you've seen one, you've seen them all. Alzheimer's, colon, not fun to have or watch someone have. Four Daughters, I'm quite excited about. That seems quite good. And as far as these nominees, I don't know, 20 Days in Mariupol seems like it's probably going to win just because of its relevance. But Four Daughters, I'm excited to watch that. Check out our website, MediaCommunity.club, for that recent review of Killers of the Flower Moon, where I really wrestle with, like, why don't I like this movie better? I will have posted a review of The Killer by the time this podcast gets edited, a movie directed by David Fincher, produced by Netflix, that has just no representation at all amongst the Oscar nominees this year. Why didn't more people like that? Mystery. I love The Killer.
That's a movie that, like, nobody has talked about for any Oscar, and
no.
If it was nominated for anything, I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, how Christopher Nolan just makes movies that look like movies. David Fincher does that even better. Just every piece of that movie looks incredible. Mm-hmm. Here or there. Maybe a future podcast, who knows. Like us on Facebook at Mutica Movie Club, Twitter at Mutica Movical, Instagram at Mutica Movie Club. Thank you for joining me tonight, Pierce.
Absolutely.
Have a good night.
See you at the Oscars, John. We're going, right? We're going to the Oscars.
Yeah, my tux is getting pressed as we speak.
Perfect.